How will Alaska educate the next generation of leaders when the state is facing a huge budget deficit? Few, if any, entities that get funding from the state will escape unscathed, including the University of Alaska system. What will this mean for the future of programs for the university? University President Jim Johnson didn't gloss over what's on the horizon, saying the cuts are going to be horrible and very challenging. President Johnson joins us to discuss what higher education in our state may look like in coming years, and we'll take your questions today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deedline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, and welcome to Talk of Alaska. President Johnson called the challenges at the university system terrible, horrible, and tough. But what does this mean, and what do university students think of the proposals for the future of programs? Today, we're joined by University System President Jim Johnson and Student Body President Jonathan Taylor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. If you are a current, past, or future university student, a parent, or citizen concerned with the future of higher education in Alaska, please call in with your questions. You can join us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. President Johnson, let's start with you. You're somewhere around 4 months or so into your first year, is that correct?
That's correct, Laurie.
When you took over as UA president, you set a goal to visit every campus in the state within your first year. Well, you're only four months into it, but how's that going?
It's going fine. I've visited 12 of the 16 campuses. Of course, we have three universities, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and then 13 community campuses across the state. So it's a tremendous honor, but it's also just a lot of fun to get out and talk with people, listen to people, more importantly, all across our state, and also to see the value of what the University of Alaska does in our communities. So it's been a great experience, and I've gotten to see some really wonderful interactions between faculty and staff. Been able to meet with school district superintendents and mayors and employers across the state to hear about, you know, really what are those community needs for higher education? What are the state's needs for higher education? So it's been a great pleasure. I'm needless to say, racking up miles that I don't need. But in any case, it's great to get around this great state.
And I should let our listeners know that President Johnson is joining us through connection with our friends at KUAC in Fairbanks. So he's in Fairbanks, we're in Anchorage. Jonathan Taylor is in the studio with me here in Anchorage, and President Johnson is in Fairbanks in the studios at KUAC. What did you hear from community members on these visits, from students, from staff, from the community? What are they saying about their concerns for the future of the system?
Well, folks are certainly concerned about the future of our university and our state, given the very difficult financial circumstances we find ourselves in. So there's concern, no question. But people also see that we are their future. We're the future for their kids, whether those kids want to study vocational technical fields or whether they want to get baccalaureate degrees or higher education somewhere else. They see, they know, that we're the path for the future, and they're critically interested in how we perform that important role for our state. I was in Kodiak recently, for example, and folks from industry and the community all came out to share with me their views on the importance, number one, of Kodiak College and the critical workforce development that it does for the maritime industry in that area. And then also we have an industry research, an applied research facility there in Kodiak. And so the community folks, industry people were talking about how important that research facility is in terms of developing new products, testing products for safety, those sorts of things. So a lot of support from the communities and, again, anxiety about our future.
Jonathan, I'd like to get you in here now as the president for UAA's campus for the students. What do you hear? What on the student level are you hearing about concern, maybe some anxiety about what the future is going to look like?
Well, I think it largely comes from two bases, I would say. The first is just the overall uncertainty, just sort of the way the university functions and the state functions in terms of budgeting. There are times where we just don't know until, pretty late on in the academic year what the next academic year might look like. And so for students who are in a degree program or who are seeking to declare or who are even looking to graduate, not this year, but maybe next year, there's concern, what is this program going to look like? Are any potential changes to the university or the university system going to do to my program? So I think generally there's that level of uncertainty just in terms of the future. There are things that we just don't know. I think the second uncertainty largely bases itself in terms of costs. It's a discussion that we've had with President Johnson as students, continue to dialogue with him and the Board of Regents in terms of as we're seeing rising costs just generally for the university and falling state funding to a degree, some cuts that are going to come obviously to the university. How then do we make sure we're maintaining that level of education we're trying to provide our students while still providing that quality? Oftentimes that does mean that tuition goes up, that fees go up. And so sometimes for many students, there is the question of costs because the difference is sometimes, am I going to be able to afford to continue my education? And if tuition goes up, if fees go up, sometimes that makes it difficult. So I think those are largely the two bases where the concern comes from.
Well, those are certainly healthy concerns, and it sounds like the students are certainly invested in what the future is going to look like and in their own education, which is good. Let's talk a little bit about that. Before we do that, I want to remind listeners that this is Talk of Alaska. We are talking with UA President, University of Alaska System President Jim Johnson by ISDN from Fairbanks. And we also have the University of Alaska Anchorage Student Body President here with us in the studio in Anchorage. Jonathan Taylor is joining us. You can join us also at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The legislature is getting underway today to tackle a wide variety of budget-related issues. It's going to be a big problem to deal with. It is a big problem to deal with. State funding is expected to be reduced essentially across the board, including the University of Alaska. President Johnson, what is your game plan for addressing the university's needs in Juneau this year?
Well, good question, Lori. We've spent quite a bit of time thinking about that and preparing for that. A lot of that preparation involves a meeting with legislators. And so that's something I've been doing over the fall, is meeting with legislators across the state to share with them our thinking about our needs and also how we are going to address the state's fiscal challenges as they impact us at the university. You know, we read the paper too. We know what's happening in our state very, very well. So we're taking a two-pronged approach. Approach one is to advocate for what we need, but only ask and advocate for what we need. And so we have a very modest budget increase proposal that our regents have approved. At the same time, you know, our budget has to go through the governor's office, and the governor's office has recommended a roughly 4.8% reduction in our state general fund base. And we are planning, so that's the second piece of it, is engaged in contingency planning. Actively across the university system over the next several months. We're actually in the midst of it now, but we'll have results from it later this spring. Once we find out what happens through the legislative process, then we'll bring that to our Board of Regents and they'll make decisions about budget for next year. So it, again, two paths. One, you know, asking for what we need in advocacy with legislators and certainly with community leaders. And then second is preparing for the contingency, the likely contingency of a reduction. And then doing, making that contingency planning focused not just on cutting, not just on hitting a number. We certainly have to. We realize that. But also to figure out how we can grow through this time, how we can invest in areas of unique strength and distinction at each one of our universities. That's going to require perhaps a little bit deeper cutting so that we're investing in growth, so that 2 years out, 3 years out, we don't sit back and say, well, we can get out from under the table now. Oil prices are up, and we survived. I don't think that's the that's strong leadership. I don't think it's what our state expects. And I think our state expects the university 2-3 years out from now to say, even though we took these reductions, we focused, we did reduce some programs, we made some tough choices, but we also invested in programs that move our state forward. Nursing education is a good example. ICER, very strong research program that's supporting public policy. Research in general, Arctic research in particular, is critically important, moving our state forward. Trying to get research out of the lab and into businesses. You know, we call that commercialization of intellectual property. We can't back away from that. That's critically important for our state now and for the future. So we've got to invest in things where we're where we can make a difference for the state, all the while cutting.
So the Board of Regents approved a $960 million budget for the upcoming fiscal year. About $350 million of that they're requesting from the state.
That's right, Lori.
So that is an increase. You're asking for, what did you say, 7%? Around a 7% increase?
That's correct. Yep. So we're asking for our fixed costs, basically, and then a very small number of new academic initiatives. But generally speaking, it's funding negotiated salary increases, health benefits cost increases, fixing leaky roofs, utility cost increases, those sort of operating buildings, that sort of thing.
The State Office of Management and Budget recommended that the university plan on a cut of around $15 million. Can you talk a little bit about why the board took this approach to ask for an increase in the face of what we see as an enormous budget deficit and the recommendations of OMB?
Well, one is that we need that money to operate. So that's big. We think it's critically important that we communicate to our legislators, to the state, what we need to operate. At the same time, as I indicated, we understand OMB's guidance, we have embarked upon a very rigorous budget contingency planning process so that by the time we figure out exactly what we get, we'll know how we're going to make the reductions necessary to move forward next year.
Are you looking at revising some of those numbers as we've, you know, in between the time that the Regents approved the budget and today, we're seeing that deficit grow larger kind of by the minute. Mm-hmm. Are you looking at revising those numbers and maybe taking a different approach to your request of the state, or are you going to just try to hold firm with what you've already submitted?
I think we're going to continue to advocate, again, for what we need. We will, at the same time, work hard to find areas where we can realize cost-effective solutions. We're looking at everything. I should say, Lori, every single thing is on the table. Sacred cows are on the table. And we're looking at things like outsourcing, public-private partnerships, again, program reductions, program elimination, program combination, where we, you know, link up programs between campuses, looking at how we can use technology more effectively to bring our cost structures down. We're looking at, again, every single thing is on the table.
Sure.
And I hate to preempt the processes that are happening at the campuses right now. They're looking at, very large reductions. They're planning for them. And if indeed those turn out to occur, we'll be ready. Because ultimately, we have a very important responsibility to Jonathan, to students across the university system, to our faculty, staff, communities, the employers who depend on us. We're going to do this well, and that takes time. When you've got academic programs in particular that have taken years to develop, and they actually take years to wind down, because we have responsibilities to those students. You know, if a student is a journalism major, we can't end that program and then drop that student on the street. We have an obligation to that student to what we call teach them out. And so there's a lot of variables in here and a lot of complexity and a lot of commitments that must be maintained as we move forward.
Jonathan has been nodding, and I think he'd like to add some comments about that very issue of continuity.
Well, from a student perspective, I guess, like President Johnson said, I think that there are those requirements that the university has to make sure that we're fulfilling, or that the university is fulfilling its obligation to students. And so there is some level of certainty there. I know, President Johnson, in your State of the University address earlier this month, you talked about using quality, cost, demand, productivity, benefits, and other metrics to determine what opportunities there are for cost efficiency throughout the system. Do we have any idea what some of those might look like, what some of those cost efficiencies might look like, both at the statewide level and then to a degree also at the campus level?
Well, I would say, Jonathan, it's a very good question, Jonathan. At the statewide level, we have a process going on right now. We call it statewide transformation, where we're assessing very closely what functions need to be done at the statewide level and what functions are better performed at a campus level, and then what functions are perhaps better not performed at all, or what functions might be outsourced to lower cost providers. So that process is probably midway, and I'll be receiving a report from the leaders of that team no later than April 1st. So that's what we're doing at the statewide. Or if for those of you in the business community, you might think that's corporate level versus a subsidiary. Now at the campuses, they're looking hard at administrative things. They've done over the last 2 years, they've made a lot of administrative reductions already, trying to save and keep the academic programs as insulated as possible from those reductions. But going forward, they're continuing to look at administrative savings, but they're also looking hard now at academic programs and looking at enrollment, looking at demand, looking at cost, looking at degrees produced. All those variables are in the mix that our campuses are looking through, and will, based on those that evaluation, will make recommendations to me and then up to the Board of Regents about what ought to happen next year to those academic programs.
Let's get some listeners in the mix here. Dennis is in Juneau, and I think he wants to also address this issue of administrators on the campuses. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, and hi to my old friend Jim. I'm an alumnus. I was one of those continuing students that kept coming back, taking a few courses at a time until I finally went back to school full time. Graduated in my early 40s, and I observed all the way through the time I was at the university that we had way too many administrators for the number of students and for the amount of administrative work that was being done. And it's my observation that administrators at the University of Alaska tend to mostly invent paperwork for each other, and it doesn't have much to do with students and much to do with instruction. And my comment would be, I certainly hope that If anybody could fix the university's over-administration, it would be Jim Johnson. And I would hope that he would very strongly consider taking some of these people that moved up on the Peter Principle to be, who were wonderfully competent instructors, ended up to being incompetent bureaucrats, putting them back in the classroom and reducing administration by about 75%, and have people stop creating paperwork for each other. And I'll hang up and listen for the answer. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for your very clear and concise comments. President Johnson, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think Dennis has a good point. When organizations grow, they bureaucratize. I'm a political scientist by training, and that's what we study. And that's what they do, pretty much inevitably. But he is right. We're taking a hard look at administrative levels and numbers. Now, one of our challenges, none of this stuff is easy and simple. We're committed to looking at this, no question about it. At the same time, we have government agencies who say, you will give us this report five times a year. You are now subject to this new law. You are now subject to this new accounting standard. You're now subject to these new regulations. And oh, by the way, not just reports that you'll need to hire people to prepare. We want you actually to develop these programs and these systems and these processes. So I would agree with Dennis's point that some of this is bureaucracy feeding itself and growing on itself. But at the same time, and I think he'd recognize this, there are also both state and federal regulations that drive a lot of this too. And so our job is to go through all of the administrations, distinguish between what's really needed and what's not, and rigorously move away from what's not needed. Because ultimately, Dennis didn't go to school because of the administrators. Jonathan doesn't go to UAA because of administrators. He goes there because of faculty and what he learns in the classroom and the opportunities that that provides him, his friends, and others to grow and pursue opportunities. And so any area that's not core academic that we can pull, we can generate savings from so that we can invest in academics, that's something we're going to do.
All right. We've had a number of email questions today. We're getting some emails in. And a couple of them are asking about combining the university system. As we know, the state is enormous. We have a system that's kind of sprawled across the state, a lot of rural and satellite campuses. Here's one question from Seward. Someone in Seward says, why can't all the state university campuses be combined into one? That would streamline the system, unify the courses, eliminate a lot of expensive administrators and unnecessary duplication. And another question is similar. How do we justify three separate university systems and the duplication of expensive majors such as engineering in this small state? What would you say about that? Let's start with Jonathan this time. Jonathan, how do you respond to those kind of ideas?
So having been in this position, my position as student body president has allowed me to get another look and a different view, I think, of the university as a system and then as separate campuses that serve different engines of the state, and I think, or different parts of the state, I should say. I think on paper, it seems like the simplest way to provide cost efficiencies is to create one university. But I think that there are two, once you start to look at it a little bit more deeply, there are two particular problems that start to rear their ugly heads, for lack of a better term. The first is, and I think President Johnson mentioned this, just some of the federal and state requirements as far as education is concerned. One university means that we would be accredited as a single institution. One university means that many of the processes that statewide has given to the individual campuses to try and create a better student experience locally would become more centralized. And so on that level, I think that you would run into some problems. I think the second area, though, is that for not just current students, but also future students and alumni, there often is a very particular tie or identity they have with their campus. Mm-hmm. You know, you look to the Mat-Su campus, for instance, even though it is a part of the UAA academic unit, a lot of people who have grown up in the Mat-Su and have been involved in that community see the positive impacts that have occurred as a result of that campus being a part of the Anchorage academic unit. And so to sort of lose that identity for a lot of individuals, I think, would be detrimental to them and would sort of change the conception of how they view the university.
That's interesting to sort of talk about the kind of distinct cultural presence, too, that comes with, even though we're all in the same state, different communities have different kind of cultural norms. And so I suppose that also influences the campus. President Johnson, how do you respond to those ideas about consolidation and not having so many programs duplicated?
Well, in terms of program duplication, I actually have a couple thoughts. The first is not always where you have more than one program is there redundancy. So let's take engineering, for example. We have two very strong engineering schools, one in Anchorage, one in Fairbanks. Those schools have very high enrollment. There's very high demand for their graduates. They are doing a very good job. They have a lot of support from the engineering community across the state. And it also, our actual, you know, by having two of those, we actually can meet the state's demand. We've doubled, by the way, the production of engineers in response to industry requests some years ago. So in that particular area, I would say that it takes two to really meet the state's needs and the state's demand for this critical occupation, engineering. Now, there are other areas where I think combination makes a lot of sense, or where one campus really does need to be the lead campus in that area. Example, it doesn't make sense to have two ICERs, for example. At Anchorage, we have the state's finest fiscal policy analysis research center. It doesn't make sense to replicate that in Juneau or Fairbanks. UAA's ICER leads our state in that area. Good for them. Move up to Fairbanks. It doesn't make sense to replicate the very strong research powerhouse, Arctic research in particular, which I would note leads the world in Arctic research. It doesn't make sense to replicate that in other parts of our state. We can't afford it. It's too expensive. Mm-hmm. And we've got one. So let's go with that. So, but to step back a little bit to respond to this question, there are positive aspects of oneness, of one university. I would say also, as Jonathan pointed out, there are positive aspects of some degree of autonomy for our three universities. He mentioned loyalty to a place and the opportunities for fundraising, for example, from alumni. Alumni don't think about the University of Alaska. Some do, certainly, but most tie it to a particular place. There's a nimbleness and a responsiveness to regional and local needs that delegation provides. And I think that's an important positive attribute of three universities. Now, one university, there are some positive attributes as well. Cost, arguably, is one. Two, transfer and consistency across the system is enhanced, I think. And also, state needs come first. They trump regional needs to some extent at the state level. And if we just had three universities, say, without a statewide, I think you'd end up, that's, by the way, the most costly model, mm-hmm. but also state needs wouldn't be met as effectively. So my view, Laurie, is that I'm trying to capture the positives of both of these models that you've described, one university or three, while trying to minimize the negatives, because both of these models, one university can be very bureaucratic, centralized, non-responsive to regional or local needs, etc. So again, Jonathan knows this because he knows me a little bit. He knows that there's probably a matrix on my desk that has the pros and cons of of one university or three universities, and he knows that, you know, I've actually written them down and think about them a lot, and to try to figure out how we can really capture the positives and minimize the negatives.
All right. Well, we are going to talk more about what that may look like in the future as the state looks at perhaps some long-term struggles with the budget and what that may mean for the University of Alaska system as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go to the phones. Patrick is in Fairbanks. Hi, Patrick.
Well, good morning to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. So I'm going to come from the man on the street, the private sector here, and looking kind of at a more smaller view. I can't look at the universe. It's too big, but I can understand the moon. And right now, we're all going through belt tightening. So I'm kind of focused in myself on something a little bit more narrow. And one of the questions, you know, when it comes to belt tightening that we're all doing, having to decide what we want, what we're going to fix in the private sector, I believe that has to be also done here. And one of the ones that raises a question with me is the tuition waivers. And I'm wondering really how much that costs the university. It was 2013, I think, was the last time it was visited, and they basically put a Band-Aid of a six-month probation period on it. And I'm really wondering, you know, in the private sector and benefits, how we're all tightening belts. We're losing benefits. We're making do with what we got. Where this really lies with what it's costing the university for these free tuition waivers for every part-time and full-time employee and their families. And on a second note on that, in the reciprocal university privilege of going out of state and they can come here, is that really a positive or a negative for us? Are more of our kids going out of state, or more of the kids coming from out of state reciprocal universities to Alaska? Are we really losing money, gaining money on that? I don't have a big urge to send my kid out of state. We can't afford it. My wife and I are both products of state university systems, have done well. We're counting on the state university system. But if it becomes too expensive, where do we go? We don't really have a need for going out of state. We couldn't afford to send our kids there anyway. So I'm going to hang up and take the answer. I'm just wondering again, this free tuition waiver for every employee and all their families, and this out-of-state reciprocal privileges, are they costing us, and what do they really cost us? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Patrick, for those thoughtful questions. President Johnson, how do you respond to this idea first of the tuition waivers?
Well, thanks. I don't have a number on the top of my head. It is not insignificant. So Patrick makes a good point. And I think also the solution for us is not going to be just as it is in a private business. It's not a silver bullet. It's a whole lot of BBs. And so you know, we're certainly looking at this. I would suggest, though, that when we look at this benefit, it's in the context of the full benefits package that the university provides its employees. And just as in a private company, you'd look at benefits in that way, so do we. Many private companies, by the way, provide these sorts of benefits to their employees. Companies I've worked for in the private sector have done that. But I would note that, you know, our health benefits, for example, here at the university, when I compare them to our single biggest market competitor. It's the state of Alaska, and they spend more on their health benefits than we spend on them for our employees. So that's one difference there. Two is there's something called the geographic differential, so that folks, employees of the state and the university and other, the feds, et cetera, when they live in high cost of living locations, they get a geographic differential for that. Ours at the university are lower than the state's. And there are a number of other examples like that where if you look at the whole picture of it, we're actually competing very effectively.
Do you think that will part of that have to be looked at, though, going forward as the university struggles with potential budget cuts? Do you think that it may get to the point where you may have to say to employees, you'll have to pony up part of the tuition? Maybe that could be how much money do you think could be raised if you said, how about if you pay a quarter of the expense of tuition?
Oh, I don't have the number off the top of my head, Lori. I can certainly, you know, provide that. It's not going to be huge, that's for sure. That doesn't let it off the table, however. That's a conversation we can certainly have. I've been at other universities where employees did pay a share. Another option was it was limited in terms of the number of credit hours that could be used. So there are all sorts of options that I think we could look at where we still maintain the value of it, but we can bring the cost of it down. I would note that tuition waiver, however, cannot be used to fill up a class. It comes in and can be used only when there are empty spots in a class.
Okay.
So that we're not dislocating another tuition or fee-paying student by the use of our tuition waiver here at the university.
Well, that's an important point for sure.
Yeah. And I, you know, go to the issue of affordability, and I can't agree more with Patrick about the critical need for our education here in Alaska to be affordable. Jonathan mentioned that. This is particularly a sensitive issue for our young people in lower and returning students in lower socioeconomic classes. They are extremely price sensitive to tuition. And if we increase our tuition a little bit, it's those folks who will decide not to attend. Folks from middle and higher socioeconomic backgrounds are much less sensitive to tuition price. So they'll say, you know, it's another X. That's no problem. I'll go ahead and eat that and move forward with my education. So I'm very concerned to make sure that we maintain our affordability. One last point, if I could, and that is when we compare our affordability, our tuition, to other Western states, that's our market, the 14 other Western states, we're at about 15% below the median. So we're low in terms of our tuition, in-state tuition, compared to other in-state tuitions across the Western states.
Before Jonathan wants to respond, but before he does, let's get something in the second point about that the last caller raised about reciprocal relationships and universities. Can you address that?
Yeah, I'd say more of our students head out for you know, a year or two. We allow that and encourage it, frankly, to leave the state and study at another university, either in the United States or internationally. And I think that number exceeds the number of those students who come here to study. Now, that's a real priority, I believe, going into the future, and that is to try to increase the number of students who come from outside of Alaska, whether in the other 49 states or internationally, to come study at the University of Alaska. And I think if we can really capitalize on the importance of the North, the importance of the Arctic, the great opportunities that students have when they come to study with us in terms of undergraduate research, access to the North, and that sort of thing, I think we'll be able to bring that, to take that number up. And of course, out-of-state students carry out-of-state tuition when they come here.
Sure. Jonathan, you wanted to get a comment in about the tuition issue.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would additionally add is I think that for some of the, I feel like we're talking about exchange programs where we have reciprocal agreements, like to a degree WAMI or WUI, things like that, where students do have an opportunity to go outside. And I think both that and to a degree providing the tuition waivers for university employees is actually a functional way that a lot of them are able to complete their education. There are a lot of people who are university employees who've been able to get a degree or get their certificate because the university has been able to provide that to them. And I think that's of great benefit to the state, too, to have students who have experience within the university and are able to graduate, but then have graduated here because they're more likely to stay here. They're more likely to put down roots here. They're more likely to build their lives here. And so I think that incentive, both that on the tuition side and then also on the exchange side, to be able to take a year or two and go outside, graduate and have an incentive to come back is really important for the future of the state as well.
Excellent points. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking today with UA President Jim Johnson about the future of the University of Alaska system. And we also have UAA Student Body President Jonathan Taylor in the studio with us. President Johnson is in the studio at KUAC joining us on the phone, and Jonathan Taylor is here in the studio of Alaska Public Media with me. I want to move on a little bit to the idea of distance education, the rural satellite offices, satellite campuses. Do you think, and this is kind of a question for both of you, do students get as much out of a class when they video conference as they do when they're in a class in person? Somebody at a distance, you're not engaged in that organic conversation that happens when you can look at someone in the room. Right now, today, we're having a conversation long distance with President Johnson. What are your thoughts about distance education, and is it as robust as someone that's actually in the classroom? Who wants to take that first? President Johnson, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. You know, I'd answer the question, Lori, that it can be every bit as robust as a class where everybody's in there face-to-face. It's a matter of how it's framed, how our students prepare. As Jonathan, I bet, would agree with me, the outcome of his education is a function much more of what he puts into it than what is provided to him. And I think that's the case with e-learning, as we call it, which increasingly is blended. It's not simply students sitting in and connected via video. There are also chats. Students, especially younger students today, are very familiar with communicating very effectively through digital media, much more so than I am. And so I think there's a level of comfort there. Also, there are study groups that are set up. So if a course is emanating out of, let's say, Anchorage, and it's being beamed into Bethel, usually what happens is that there are students in Anchorage and Bethel taking that course together, if connected via video. And then the students in Bethel will have their own study groups. They will have mentors and others in Bethel who can help them work through that coursework. So I think it can be every bit as robust as face to face. And so I think there's also real tremendous opportunities in terms of getting higher quality content developed more cost effectively out to rural Alaska. You know, our costs out there are very high, but our mission there is critically important. And so I've tasked a group here at the university to look hard at how we can maintain, if not enhance, the level of service in our rural communities while bringing our high cost structures down. And one of the answers to that question is technology and e-learning technologies.
Jonathan, did you want to add something quickly?
I would very much agree with that. I think that obviously one other thing to note is e-learning is the future. That's what my generation and presumably the generation after me, that's the way a lot of us learn. So those distance courses, I think, are valuable. There are technological resources, things like open educational resources. There is a staff member at the university here in Anchorage who just received, I believe it's a Title III grant to work on providing some OERs that allow faculty to build courses that they can provide quality education to students in a face-to-face manner, but then also make those courses available across the university so they could be delivered via video conference, or they could be delivered via distance, via, you know, Blackboard or something like that. So I think it often depends on the input that the student is going to put into it, the work, mm-hmm. and also the quality of that course in and of itself.
Well, I would have to say, though, as someone who works for a radio system in the state, that we have 26 stations across the state. They have varying degrees of internet connectivity. Some of them can download programs really quickly. Some of them cannot. And the mm-hmm. same would be true for a lot of these communities that want this distance education. We are not going to have connectivity in all the communities in Alaska for a very long time, who knows how long that will be before that happens, if it ever happens. When you have a small community, it costs a lot to run that connection. What is your answer to folks who are in these communities who are having a tough time getting access to this? What is the answer for them? Are they simply just going to be faced with having to travel to get education? President Johnson, what would you say to rural Alaska about distance education?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I think that to some extent, travel is going to be needed. Of course, Alaskans travel a lot, as you know. So I think that's part of the equation. Another is the technology itself. More and more, distance education is not done symmetrically. That is, somebody in a big city in some sort of classroom or video lab is transmitting out to a rural location. Increasingly, it is asymmetrical. And that is that the lecture, the class is packaged and can be distributed in a way that doesn't require a lot of bandwidth. And then the students are able to participate in that class, work through that content, and they don't have to be online to do it. So that's one of the approaches, I think, that you see increasingly in the e-learning field is this notion of asymmetric delivery.
So they're gold streaking them out to communities?
in part, or you know, when demand for bandwidth in rural communities is lower, that's when it gets shot out there.
Sure.
And it, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't need to be live, right? They can actually take a few minutes to transfer that packet of content.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Steve is in Juneau. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I just got a quick question. I would like to know if there are any plans to establish a law school in the state of Alaska. And if so, when that might be, and if not, why not? And thank you for your time, and I'll take the call offline here.
Thank you, Steve, for your question. President Johnson, are we going to expand into a law school?
Well, Steve's it's a good question, and it has been asked and answered by the regents a number of times over the years. We're the only state in the country without a law school. Now, some out there in the listening audience may cheer and say the last thing we need is more attorneys. But there are others out there who think, well, you know, we ought to have people practicing the law who understand our state and know what's going on here. As I understand it, the last time the regents looked at this, what really was problematic was the cost. The American Bar Association controls this, as I understand it, and they require a dedicated law library for the law school. And it's not just a law library with computer terminals in it so that people can do electronic searches. No, it is a dedicated law library with hardcover books in it. Extremely expensive enterprise. And so the last time the Board of Regents looked at it, the decision was, wow, that's a cost we can't bear. Now, I kind of thought naively that, gosh, we've got all these law libraries across the state, and I don't know an attorney who uses a hardcover book anymore to do legal research. I think they're all pretty much using the web for it. But apparently that's still a requirement from the ABA. So that's the last time the regents looked at it. And I haven't heard any, in the 4 months I've been back here at the university, I haven't heard any of them suggest we look at it again.
All right, we have to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll have a response from Jonathan Taylor as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
All right. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the future of the university system, and we have President Jim Johnson on the line from Fairbanks at KUAC, and Jonathan Taylor is in the studio here in Anchorage with me. He is the student body president for UAA. Jonathan, you wanted to respond to this idea of law school.
Yeah, the thing that I was going to say is I agree with the president. There are some challenges. I think those challenges are opportunities. There's been some unique partnerships that exist and have been created. I feel like as a result of that, UAA has a 3-in-3 program with Washington School of Law, mm-hmm. where students have the opportunity to take essentially 3 years, their first 3 years of undergraduate here at UAA, and then take their first 3 years of law school or their 3 years of law school down at University of Washington and complete their senior year then while they're down in Washington. I think those are opportunities that are created even with those types of challenges that are ultimately, I think, help us deal with some of those problems.
Sure. Well, let's go back to the phones quickly. Dario is in Anchorage. Hi, Dario.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
My concern is the cost of athletics. It was probably the mid-90s, I guess, when I was up at Fairbanks. And I realized how much it cost to get into those play the different sports of basketball and hockey where we were traveling to the East Coast or the Midwest, I guess, and then paying those other teams way to come up here. And I remember back about 1970 when AMU used to have a hockey team that actually played in the city men's league. The students loved it. It probably didn't get as big a crowd as if they were playing Duke University or whatever, but the costs were reasonable. And if you wanted to give a couple of scholarships for the sport, you could afford to give local kids scholarships rather than having to recruit from Minnesota.
Okay, so the cost of the athletics program. President Johnson, do you have some information about that?
Sure do. As there are costs, there are benefits. So let me preface it by saying that there's a lot of pride and community connection that comes from athletic programs. Our student athletes, there are about 300-ish across our university system. Fairbanks and Anchorage compete in Division II. Athletics, and then have D1 teams in a few areas. Hockey is the example there. So there are some real positives that do come from our intercollegiate athletic programs. Dario is correct, however, that they come at a price, and it's a significant price. Basically, state funds go into it. Mandatory student fees go into it. So the question really is it worth that? And just like I said at the beginning of this interview, everything is on the table: administrative programs, academic programs, athletic programs. Important as they are in building connections with our community, will be on the table for a rigorous look as we go through this budget contingency process that I described earlier.
Let's talk a little bit about, go back to the idea of consolidation. Oftentimes I hear Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau campuses referred to, and I think, Preston Johnson, you may have actually said this morning, as Alaska's three universities. But mm-hmm. of course, we have three primary campuses, along with a number of satellite and extensions. A report in 2011 commissioned by then-President Pat Gamble, written by James Fisher, actually kind of concurred with a 2008 report saying that some of the UA system is too centralized and conversely, mm-hmm. some services are too redundant. The report said 60 to 80 positions out of a possible 200 could possibly be cut. What do you think about that idea?
That's exactly, those two reports are what has prompted the statewide transformation process that I described. And I wouldn't say it's 60 or 80 necessarily, but it's a significant number of positions. We have already reduced substantially in our statewide office through attrition over the last couple of years. But as we look to the future, I can foresee a number of positions being reduced. Now, that said, these are not people just sitting around with their feet on desks. These are people who work. So a lot of the work they do will have to be done someplace. And if it's not done at the statewide administration, it's going to be done at the campuses. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be ways that they can scale or have the capacity at the campuses to perform those duties with less people. And that's fine. And that's exactly what we're working through today in that statewide transformation process.
All right. Let's give Jonathan a quick chance to respond here, and then hopefully we can get one more question in.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes it is those transitions and those changes and that streamlining that President Johnson is talking about that gets us that more streamlined student experience, so that regardless of where students are interacting with the university, whether it's enrolling, whether it's filling out a scholarship application, whether it's financial aid question, I think that hopefully as the transition continues, we'll start to continue to see some of that streamlined student experience where at the contact level with the student, they know that they can expect that the same answers, that same level of service, and that same high quality from regardless of where they are.
All right, we only have about a minute left. President Johnson, we had a caller question come in. Have wage cuts for employees been considered, perhaps something like 15% over 3 years, 5% per year, with the provision that it would be restored when finances are better? This came in from a caller. Your response to that?
Well, my personal view is that we need to look vertically rather than horizontally at how we reduce our cost structures. I want to have us perhaps do less better with market competitive pay than to do a lot across the board with a lot of disgruntled people who just took pay cuts who may not get an increase in the future. So that's one thought. The second thought, I think we get stronger and better that way. The second thought is we have commitments that we have made to our people. We have commitments in policy. We have commitments in labor contracts. And so we do not have the legal right to simply go in and do what's suggested there. I want to make damn sure that we are paying our people what we can, what the market bears, so that we are able to recruit and retain top quality people, because those are the folks who are going to teach Jonathan and move our university forward in the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much to our guest today, University of Alaska President Jim Johnson by ISDN from KUAC in Fairbanks, and UAA student body President Jonathan Taylor in the studio here with me in Anchorage. Thank you to both of you. Thanks to Dave Waldron on the board and Josh Edge on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.